Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, so today we're diving deep into a book that, well, practically defines American literature in the 20th century, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby.
Absolutely. And Fitzgerald himself, I mean, he lived from 1896 to 1940, right through the heart of the jazz age he wrote about. He wasn't just watching it, he felt it.
Yeah, it's like he held up this incredibly insightful, maybe slightly warped mirror to the roaring 20s, all that economic boom, the social upheaval.
But also the hollowness underneath. It's fascinating, though, that when it came out in 1925, it wasn't a huge hit.
Really? Kind of surprising now.
Yeah, modest sales, pretty mixed reviews. It took until after World War II for it to really find its place, you know, to be seen as this masterpiece of modernism and, crucially, this sharp critique of the American dream.
And that's really our focus today, isn't it? We're looking beyond the tragic love story on the surface, Gatsby and Daisy. We want to get at how that personal story serves as this, well, truly scathing commentary on how the American dream got tangled up with just pure materialism, and how class lines were so brutally rigid.
And to get that, you absolutely have to picture the setting. Fitzgerald drops us right into the thick of it. Long Island, summer of 1922. It's hot, it's tense.
And immediately sets up this key distinction, this social geography.
Mm-hmm. You've got West Egg and East Egg.
West Egg is the new money territory. People who maybe made their fortunes quickly, possibly not entirely legally.
Like bootlegging, perhaps?
Exactly. And sometimes the style is a bit
much.
A bit gaudy. That's where our narrator, Nick Carraway, lives. And right next door, the mysterious Jay Gatsby, famous for his enormous parties.
Then just across the bay, and that physical separation is so important, you have East Egg.
Old money.
Yeah, the established families, inherited wealth, that sort of aristocratic air. It's a kind of respectability, maybe, that the West Eggers can't quite buy. And that's where Nick's cousin, Daisy Buchanan, lives with her husband, Tom, who is, well, quite a piece of work.
He really is. So Nick, our narrator, he's this guy from the Midwest trying to make it in the bond business. He sort of becomes our eyes and ears, our moral compass, supposedly.
At first, yeah. He gets pulled into the orbit of his cousin Daisy and the very imposing Tom straight away.
But the story quickly shifts focus, doesn't it? From Nick just observing to Gatsby and his massive, all-consuming quest.
It's everything. Gatsby's whole existence, all those parties, that huge mansion, it's all a stage set designed for one purpose.
To win back Daisy.
Exactly. He was desperately in love with her 5 years before, pre-war, but he was poor then. Penniless, basically. She married Tom instead.
So Gatsby spends those 5 years building this, frankly, enormous fortune, hinted pretty strongly to be from bootlegging, dealing with shady characters.
All of it just to impress her, to show her he's worthy now. And this is key, he genuinely believes he can erase those 5 years, just wipe the slate clean.
And that's the core conflict, isn't it? This incredibly romantic, almost delusional dream of Gatsby's crashing headlong into the, well, the harsh, cynical reality of Daisy and Tom's world.
It forces you, the reader, to ask that big question. Can you actually repeat the past? Can you just rewind time?
Fitzgerald seems to have a pretty brutal answer.
Oh, yeah. Unequivocal.
So let's dig into these characters a bit, starting with Gatsby himself, or should we say James Gatz? That's his real name.
Right. He completely reinvented himself. Nick calls him out for having this extraordinary gift for hope, this kind of romantic readiness. He's the embodiment of the self-made man, in a way.
But the self he made is, well, it's built on lies. And crime, that incredible wealth, it's dirty. And his whole lifestyle, it's a performance for Daisy, an audience of one.
His tragedy is that steadfast devotion. He pours everything into this idealized image of Daisy, this dream that's sort of frozen in time from 5 years ago.
And he just cannot accept, or maybe won't accept, that the real Daisy, the one living across the bay, doesn't match up. She can't live up to that dream.
Which brings us to Daisy, the golden girl. She's described as captivating, beautiful, charming. But what's the line Nick uses about her voice?
Oh, yes. Her voice is full of money.
That says so much, doesn't it? It's not just that she has money. It's that her very essence, her allure, is intertwined with wealth and status.
Gatsby sees this epic love, this soulmate connection. But Daisy, she seems fundamentally incapable of that kind of commitment, that kind of sacrifice.
She's trapped by her own luxury, really. When push comes to shove, she retreats back into the safety and security of Tom's world, of that old money fortress. She's beautiful, but maybe hollow.
And the guardian of that fortress is Tom Buchanan, He's definitely the antagonist here.
No question. He represents everything Gatsby is trying to overcome. That inherited arrogance, the entitlement, the blatant hypocrisy of the upper class.
He's physically imposing, aggressive, cheats on Daisy constantly without a second thought.
But is absolutely outraged at the idea of Daisy leaving him. It's all about maintaining control, his social dominance. He's this immovable object of reality that exists to shatter Gatsby's fantasy.
He doesn't change at all through the story, does he?
Not one bit. He's static. Protected.
Unlike Nick, Nick Carraway actually goes on the most significant journey, I think.
I agree. He starts as this sort of detached, maybe slightly naive observer, trying hard not to judge anyone.
Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope, he says at the start.
Right. But by the end, well, the things he witnesses, the selfishness, the carelessness, the moral vacuum, they completely disillusion him. He becomes the judge. And his judgment is harsh.
Yeah, he ends up condemning that whole wealthy elite. It's his moral awakening that really drives this novel's critique home for us, the readers.
Definitely. Fitzgerald uses Nick's disillusionment brilliantly.
Okay, let's talk about some key moments. We don't need to recount every single party, but some images just stick with you, like early on, before Nick really knows what's going on.
When he sees Gatsby out on his lawn at night.
Yes, standing alone in the dark, reaching out across the water.
Trembling. Reaching towards that single green light at the end of Daisy's dock.
It's such a powerful image. That light is everything, isn't it? It's the past, it's the dream, it's Daisy, it's everything he wants but can never quite grasp. That orgastic future, as Fitzgerald calls it near the end, always just out of reach.
Such a perfect symbol. And then the story starts to peel back Gatsby's layers.
Yeah, the carefully constructed facade begins to crack. He tells Nick these slightly unbelievable stories about himself. Oxford, war medals.
But then Nick meets Meyer Wolfsheim.
Ah, Wolfsheim, the man who fixed the 1919 World Series.
Mm.
Suddenly, Gatsby's connections seem a lot less glamorous and a lot more criminal.
It confirms the source of the money. It's not just new. It's illicit, bootlegging, shadowy deals.
And then Jordan Baker, Daisy's friend, fills Nick in on the backstory. The real reason Gatsby bought that huge house.
The aha moment. It was all for Daisy. To be across the bay from her. The parties were just bait, hoping she'd wander in one night.
So intense. And the reunion itself, when it finally happens in Nick's little bungalow.
Oh, Gatsby's a wreck. So awkward and anxious. Completely loses his cool.
But then later, at his mansion, showing Daisy all his possessions. That scene with the shirts.
He's just throwing these piles of beautiful, expensive shirts, silk, flannel, linen onto the bed. It's this desperate display of wealth.
And Daisy starts crying.
Yeah, but why? It's so telling. Mm. Is it because she's moved by his love? Or is it?
It seems like she's crying for the life they could have had if he'd had this money 5 years ago. It's mourning the lost financial possibility, almost more than the lost love. The dream is so tangled up with money.
Exactly. And that dream starts to sour pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when Daisy finally comes to one of his big parties?
She hates it. She finds it vulgar, repellent. All that new money showiness. It offends her East Egg sensibilities.
And Gatsby is crushed. Because he still thinks he can somehow fix everything just the way it was before. He just doesn't get that she has changed, that time has changed things.
Which leads us inevitably to that sweltering, horrible day and the confrontation at the Plaza Hotel in New York.
The tension is unbearable. The heat mirrors the emotional pressure cooker.
And Tom, feeling cornered, just lays into Gatsby. Exposes him as a bootlegger, a fraud, basically common scum in his eyes.
And this is the moment of truth for Daisy. Can she leave Tom for Gatsby?
And she falters. She admits she did love Tom once. She can't say she only ever loved Gatsby.
Which shatters Gatsby's illusion, that core belief that the past 5 years could be erased, gone, in an instant.
The drive back from the city is just disaster. Daisy is distraught, driving Gatsby's big yellow car way too fast.
And Myrtle Wilson, Tom's mistress, who lives in that bleak valley of ashes, runs out into the road.
And Daisy hits her. Kills her instantly.
But Gatsby, his immediate reaction is pure misguided devotion. He tells Nick he'll take the blame. He'll say he was driving to protect Daisy.
One last desperate act. But the carelessness of the Buchanans is what seals his fate.
It's chilling. Tom finds out it was Gatsby's car. He doesn't know Daisy was driving, or maybe he doesn't care. He tells George Wilson, Myrtle's grieving husband.
Tells him the yellow car belongs to Gatsby. And strongly implies Gatsby was Myrtle's lover, which wasn't true.
Wilson just mad with grief and rage, gets a gun, finds Gatsby floating in his pool, probably finally relaxing for the first time.
And shoots him dead. Then turns the gun on himself.
just brutal. And the final insult.
The funeral. All those hundreds of people who came to his parties, drank his liquor, used his house.
Almost none of them show up. It's Nick, Gatsby's father, and who else? Owl Eyes? The guy from the library.
Pretty much. It just underscores the absolute emptiness of that social world he tried so hard to enter. Nick is left totally alone, feeling betrayed, having to arrange everything, while Tom and Daisy...
They retreat back into their money, their vast carelessness, leaving the mess for others to clean up.
Which loops us right back to those central themes.
Yeah.
This is Fitzgerald's indictment of the American dream, right?
Yeah.
How it became twisted into just chasing wealth.
Yeah, Gatsby's dream, however intense, however hopeful, just couldn't break through those rigid class barriers. His money, even though it was vast, was the wrong kind, and his idealism was tragically misplaced.
And it hammers home that point about the past. You can't recapture it. Trying to force it is destructive. Gatsby's refusal to accept that is his fatal flaw.
And Nick's final judgment on Tom and Daisy, that quote, is just devastating. They were careless people.
They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness and let other people clean up the mess they had made. Oof. That sums up the moral critique perfectly.
It really does. And the symbols reinforce it all. We talked about the green light, but what about the eyes on the billboard?
The eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. Yeah, overlooking the Valley of Ashes, that wasteland between the eggs and the city. They're like the eyes of God, maybe, but a God who just watches, detached, absent, as everything falls apart. No judgment, no intervention, just observing the decay.
It creates the sense of a moral vacuum. And the reason the story hits so hard, I think, is the injustice of it all.
Totally. Gatsby, for all his flaws and his crimes, is punished. But not really for the crimes, more for daring to dream above his station, for trying to crash the East Egg Party.
While the truly destructive, careless people, the Buchanans, they get away scot-free. Their wealth protects them. They face no consequences.
So the ultimate tragedy here isn't just lost love. It's about misplaced idealism, isn't it? It's about pinning all your hopes on something hollow, something corrupted by wealth and status, and building that dream on a shaky, dishonest foundation. Even with Gatsby's incredible gift for hope, he was doomed.
Absolutely. And that final line of the novel... It just stays with you. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What currents are we all fighting against in our own lives? What pasts are we constantly being pulled back towards? It's such a resonant, haunting image.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.